Ladies, gentlemen, paramours, Casanovas, romantic role players of all breeds, welcome to a bonus episode this Valentine's Day of the Human Energy Field. Play some French cafe accordion music and light some candles. We will be talking about romance in and out of the role-playing game experience. Whether you're with a partner, whether you're hopeless or hopeful romantic, we should have some content for you as long as you like picking up dice and role-playing. I am here with my host, Jamie, as always. Jamie, why are we doing this episode, my friend? Why did we choose this?
Well, I think obviously we're in our first year, and it'd be nice to do bonus episodes to mark what we colloquially call the holidays. So, you know, Valentine's Day being, you know, lumped into those Hallmark holidays. But on a broader aspect, I think love, relationships, sex, all of these kind of subjects are things that are quite often overlooked in role-playing games, even though they form quite a large part of the human condition. We all deal with them. We all have thoughts about them one way or another. So really, I think it's an opportunity for us to explore that subject. Like you say, relationships on and off the table, in and out of the game, and how it affects people's gaming experience and things like that.
When role-playing, we try to emulate or at least fabricate elements of the human condition. And you're right, that's something that's very often missed out on, or we might feel awkward bringing it up, or we might feel like we're missing out on a part of role-playing. We might want to represent someone who's different than ourselves, and through that representation try to experiment with different ways of loving someone, different ways of seeing people. I think that definitely can all be included into the more mature kind of role-playing space without it descending into giggling and high school kind of rosy cheekness about who fancies who and that kind of thing. I think there's certainly a way to approach it that will allow role players to expand their minds a little bit.
Yeah, and I think you're right to touch on that straight away, because that's part of the problem, I think, with discussing anything like relationships and love and sex, etc., in role-playing games, because it's that snigger factor where people are giggling and sniggling and can kind of ruin what really can be part of a good story. Because if we think back to what role-playing is really about, you know, the stories around the fire, the retelling of myths, there aren't many of these original old stories which don't include some form of romance or eroticism. So to kind of cast that entirely out of the toolbox, if you will, is to kind of miss, I think, one of those solid pillars of myth. And it's a real shame. So maybe this conversation that we have might spur some GMs and players to reintroduce that element back into their games, in minor or major ways, and to rethink the way that they do that. And also maybe some top tips about handling issues in games, whether, you know, as I say, whether it's players or characters.
Yeah, it does bring with it quite a lot of issues. So hopefully with a bit of common sense and an open mind, those are the sort of things that you can resolve. So I've been doing a bit of research for this chat that we're having, and I have categorised RPGs into three types that have come up in my research. There are RPGs that focus gameplay on romance, where the romance or the relationship is the gameplay. There are RPGs that include romance and relationships in the mechanics of the game, and there are RPGs that never mention them at all and completely gloss over them. Something like D&D, for example, rarely even mentions relationships or how characters should interact in a romantic way, whereas a lot of the smaller indie games I've found base themselves entirely around what it means to have a relationship. So there's a big kind of divide there.
I think you're absolutely right. What I would consider most of the traditional role-playing games fall into, the way that you've categorised them, into that third category, into that category where they're not really dealt with at all. And I think maybe part of the reason that a lot of these new indie games do focus on relationships is it's the chance to fill a void, the chance to take up that mantle which has been kind of put to one side by traditional role-playing games, and to delve with something new, which is great, and that's applaudable. And you know, I like it when new games designers and thinkers approach things from a fresh direction and introduce things that we haven't seen. But those three categories do blur quite a little bit. And I would think, as you've quite rightly said, you know, the first category, games that deal exclusively and directly with relationships, must be very, you know, they're minimal. I mean, you know, we can count them on a couple of hands. I can't name that many off the top of my head. Whereas most games will fall into the third camp. So I think when we really get into talking about the meat of this, I think we'll probably be talking about the way to deal with this subject in those major games, whether it be D&D, Call of Cthulhu, Shadowrun, Cyberpunk, all of those kind of things, you know.
Right, right, okay. I mean, yeah, there are, if it's something that you want to go out and actively search for and play in, there are those games that are based around the concept of a relationship, the idea of a partnership between two people. I've actually pulled some off my shelf to talk about briefly, so I'll let me just mention a few for you. Maybe you've heard of some of these. I have a game here called Kintsugi, which is by a games writer called Noella Handley. Kintsugi is a time-traveling relationship RPG. You have three players, and you examine the relationship between two people at three different points in time. And it's sort of like a Marty McFly situation where you're trying to steer the past and the present to reach the outcome that you've all decided on. You're looking at these snapshots in time of a relationship between these people, and it's based around this one partnership that you create.
Now, I've never heard of this, but I'm going to take a wild stab in the dark and say that the page count on this is below 20.
Oh, I've got it on a postcard.
Right, okay. Now, I see, and I'm not gonna put this down, you know, concepts are great, and you know, everything that I've just said, I applaud games designers moving forward with ideas that haven't been done and fresh ideas. But to me, something so small, I don't class that as a role-playing game. It's an idea, it's a concept, it's a parlor game, do you know what I mean?
It's a
discussion game. It's a discussion game you can have, and I think we have to be careful of what we're going to decide classifies as a role-playing game, just for the purposes of our conversation, not in a wider, you know, I'm not wanting to decide what a role-playing game is for everybody. There'll be different things to different people. But for me, and in terms of when I'm talking about role-playing games, that's not really a role-playing game to me.
Okay, right.
You know, does it have character generation mechanics? Does it have, you know, skill test mechanics? Or is it just the idea that we're going to sit down and tell a lovely story between ourselves? Because that's something great and enjoyable, and you know, you call it a role-playing game because you are essentially playing a role. But to me, I mean, come on, if it's on a postcard, I mean, I don't know how much that takes to do that, you know.
How deep can you go with something that's so small compared to, for example, Shadowrun?
Yeah, and I mean, I know it almost seems like I'm comparing chalk and cheese here, and I realise that would be a lot of people who think that, but I just think when I'm talking about role-playing games, if I start folding in all of these kind of theatrical, you know, discussion games that to me aren't really role-playing games. I mean, is there any mechanics? Is there any dice rolling in this game?
Yeah, yeah. There's all the challenges are resolved with a sort of rock, paper, scissors kind of interaction. So there's there's no numerical dice rolls, but there is a challenge rating that the players have with each other.
Right, okay. And, you know, I haven't read this, and, it might be a great postcard, you know, by the time I've got through it all. But it sounds great, and, you know, I think to talk about that one game that you've brought up, that's a very different leisure time expectation from that sitting down than if you sit down to play what I would call a classic role-playing game, D&D, where you create characters and go on an adventure and everything. I understand that's why you brought it to the table, because, you know, we are talking about relationships, etc. But this to me sounds more like a psychology exercise than a role-playing game.
I suppose it is, in a way. I like that you termed a parlor game. That seems quite fitting for these small, little kind of storytelling things, yeah.
And I want to put out there that I'm not dictating or judging how anybody wants to spend their leisure time. If you're having a great time with whatever system, however light or heavy it is, that's great. I mean, that is the core thing, that the getting together and playing games and having a good time is key. That's the golden rule. So that's great. But for me personally, once I step back from that having been said, this to me is not what I term as a role-playing game. If I was invited round to play a role-playing game at somebody's house and they got this postcard out, I think I'd feel a bit misled, I think.
On the other side of the spectrum, another game that I've pulled off my shelf is Apocalypse World 2nd Edition. Now, this game is maybe fits into the category that you're talking about a little bit more. It's not based around any kind of ideas of relationships, but on your playbook sheets, each character has a special move which happens when you have sex with another player, specifically then and only then. Do you know about this? Yeah,
I know of it. I've read a few of the books, but I haven't really played much of it, to be fair.
Well, I think one of the appeals of the Powered by the Apocalypse system for me is that there's a lot of different ways you can approach it. I've ran whole campaigns of Apocalypse World start to finish. I did like a 6-month long one with some friends. And I found that it's quite an open-ended system. I think a lot of the sessions I played, when we sat down for sessions in that campaign, the players would have their playbooks in front of them. They'd be looking at these moves that say, when you and another character have sex, you gain a point in whatever it might be, or they lose a point in something. And we'd always bring them up and talk about them at the table, but they never came into play, and an opportunity never came up organically for a player to go, oh, you know what, me and this other player are actually having sex, so let me draw for my sex move. It was never something that we really steered the game towards. It was never something that really came up naturally, but the fact that it's there, and that someone took the time to design a sex move, if you like, for each of these different character classes in the Apocalypse World, I guess, is it good that they covered the bases? Is it something that is necessary to have in there?
My initial reaction to something like this being included into a set of mechanics is that it seems to be the counter of the X card idea. So with all these new indie games, it came this idea of the X card, and I'm sure everybody listening kind of knows what the X card is, but it's an agreed upon method whereby any player can raise the issue that they're not comfortable with whatever's happening in a non-verbal, non-confrontational way, and the GM will just speed on to the next point in the game and move away from whatever it is that's troubling that particular player.
It's like a veto.
With no discussion. Now, I don't like the X card in my particular kind of game. I would rather have a frank and full discussion with the players that I'm going to play with and try and ascertain who they are as people, and etc., and all these other safeguarding issues. But I can totally understand why an X card works in the modern world, and especially between people who don't know each other particularly well, mm-hmm. especially in a conventional tournament sense. Mm-hmm. I can see it being a useful health and safety tool. But if anything is going to make players reach for an X card, it's going to be either the mention of or the inclusion of sex in any fashion in a role-playing game, because there's a lot of things come up there. And I think a lot of people who do have any hang-ups that may cause them to reach for an X card, a lot of those may be related to sex and sexual ideas. Some will be violence and drugs and other things that might scare them. But to me, I just think you're almost asking for that X card to be used, or you're making it more likely that it is.
Even if an X card is never used, is it not nice to just have it under your hand, just in case? Or I suppose the idea is that you have an agreed upon game with the players to an extent where you're all comfortable enough that you shouldn't need one. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, and I mean, it's difficult because, as I've just said, I understand the concept of an X card can be very useful, especially among strangers and people who don't know each other very well. It's a great tool to avoid what might be a really awkward situation. And I've played role-playing games for a long time, and I have been in the situations, many, many years
ago,
before this concept existed, where people have been really upset by what's happening in a game. Thankfully, not always games I've ran, some that I've been players in, some that I've ran, but I've seen it happen, and it can be really awkward for the person, and it can be really awkward for the people running it and the other players. So I can totally understand why the X card exists. But my point is, if you run a game where there are particular bonuses or benefits or drawbacks that will occur when you and another PC have sex, then you are increasing the likelihood that one of the players around the table is going to feel uncomfortable enough to touch the X card. That's my thought process.
I mean, it's almost like you as a player, you're looking down at what's in front of you because you're saying, how can I interact with the world? What tools have I got at my fingertips that I can use in whatever way possible? And that includes both the sex move and the X card simultaneously.
I just wonder if I'm given a character and I sit down at a table and I'm told that one of the options for me to get a certain point or whatever is to have sex with one of the other players. Now, then I turn to my player on the left, be it a man or a woman or whoever, and I initiate sexual contact with them. I in-game attempt to bring in-game. Up the idea that I bring up the idea that my character wants to have sex with their character. And that character becomes extremely uncomfortable, either because they think I'm hitting on them, or you know what I mean, or not, or it's inappropriate, or they have whatever makes them uncomfortable about the situation.
Okay.
I just think there's a lot of things I can do in a role playing game that is probably not going to upset the player on my left. I think wanting to have sex with them in the game is far more likely to upset them than anything else I do, like shooting someone or, you know, robbing treasure or burning down a barn full of orphans, and, do you know what I mean? All that kind of stuff.
Yeah, which is funny, you know, that, isn't it, really, in a way?
It is, but because the person on my left probably isn't an orphan who was set alight in a barn too at some point, you know, so that's not going to trigger him or her.
Right.
Whereas it's much more likely that people who do bring issues to a table, those issues will be wrapped around this idea of intimacy.
Right.
So I think that, I just think if a group wants to be mature enough to handle those themes within its own game, I think that's great. I applaud that. I'm sure we'll talk about a way to push that in to games. But I just think a set of mechanics that actively encourages that to happen is almost asking for trouble.
I think so. It's a tricky issue to navigate. And if you're trying to push your players in the direction of making those interactions with each other in a way that isn't either pre-agreed upon or comes about organically, then yeah, you're asking for trouble in a way. I would much rather, as a player, I'd much rather have a game with no mention of sex in the rules, but some sort of romance or relationship develops itself naturally over time. Maybe I'm playing someone and my character is saved by another character in a gallant or heroic way, and I decide, oh, actually, you know what, my character is the sort of person who would actually find that attractive. And then it's a little seed that's planted that I can then nourish if I want to, depending on how my character perceives the other character. I think that's a much more natural way of bringing about these kind of feelings to the table, as opposed to going, oh, the Gunlugger special move is that if I fuck you, I get this. It's not very, it's a bit heavy-handed, isn't it?
I absolutely agree with you. And I think if this was, you know, if I'm in a relationship with another character, I get this point. Or, do you know what I mean? But it's not. It's specifically if I have sex with this character.
Right, it is a sex thing, yeah.
Yeah, and I just think that that's a kind of different way of looking at it, because then sex can carry with it, oh, well, you know, come on, let's do it because I want this point. Do you know what I mean? And I just think that's not a great reason to do anything.
Well, it's just metagaming, isn't it?
Yeah, it's metagaming. But also, I think, you know, what you're talking about with, you know, the development of relationships inside games between characters or between PCs and NPCs, quite often the sex element of it would be glossed over anyway, as it would be in a movie or a TV show. You know, obviously some are a little bit more explicit and we would see those actions, you know, Game of Thrones or whatever it happens to be. And in other stories, it would be a fade to black, or you would see them wake up in the morning. And I think that's probably the best way to deal with it in most role-playing games. And I'm not a prude, but I don't want to role-play out. I don't want to talk about the actual sex that the PCs and the NPCs are having, or the PCs and the PCs are having. I think it's enough to know that they spent the night together or went alone together at some point, and we can all as human beings, you know, use our imagination as to what went on there to a lesser or greater degree. I think the mention of sex and is more vulgar than just pushing PCs and NPCs to have relationships with each other.
I agree. And it's hardly ever about the action itself, more the idea of the coupling has occurred or the relationship has reached a point where they're now taking that step together or something. I'd always try and find the narrative or the drama or the story behind the fact that the action is happening rather than the action itself.
And I think it's bad enough that the mechanics might include some sort of benefit to a character for this, but it's even worse. The mechanics may include some sort of drawback to a character for this, because that has a load of insinuations in it that aren't particularly nice. I think that are quite dark. And I certainly wouldn't want in my game, you know, I wouldn't want to be discussing why one of the PCs is negatively affected by the sexual experience between their character and another character.
Yeah, I mean, I enjoy an adult game as much as the next person, but that's not something that I would be interested in including in a game, I don't think, no.
No, me neither.
But on the flip side, I like the idea of a innocent kind of chivalric romance if I have a character who's some sort of knight or paladin, and his driving force, similar to Don Quixote, is that he has his main motivation is his lost love, who isn't anywhere nearby and he never sees her, but she keeps him motivated and energized throughout everything he's doing. You know, he exclaims his love for her to anyone who will listen. You know, it can be a very nice and innocent facet of a character if chosen to play on that other side completely, on the other direction.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there are plenty of games that have attempted to tackle these kind of issues to some degree over the years that I've thought have done really well with it. But to me, to come to a game that, you know, I sound like I'm a broken record, but a game that has mechanics that actively want to discuss sex between the characters, it doesn't sit right with me somehow. I just think even if it worked fine, I just think I'm just increasing the chance that someone's going to be upset. So why bother? What is the reward worth the risk? Would be my
right.
Would be how I would weigh it up. Is the game going to be better for this?
So what is then in that case? What is the ideal kind of setting or game that you would say, you know what, I'm confident me and the players could bring this element in? What's the ideal kind of game that you'd want to have going on for something like that to happen?
Do you know what? I mean, I think you can bring in the idea of relationships and romance and eroticism into any game. And I think that's something that we can get into talking about. And I think it should be encouraged to be brought into most games. And quite often what will happen is when you lay those seeds into NPCs or to plot lines, the players will determine whether they want to get into it or not. All the GM has to do is scatter the seeds. The players' interests will make it grow or not. And if the player group seems to be interested in that sort of thing and it develops, then that becomes a rich vein of storytelling for that particular game. And if it doesn't, those seeds will lie fallow and it's fine. And the GM knows just to move on without doing anything else. So we can definitely discuss how to lay those seeds and things like that. But I don't think it should be something that you would sit down as a GM and go, right, okay, so this session or this game is going to be about sex.
Right. Yeah.
I don't think that's a great approach. I mean, there are some games that deal with sex a lot more. I mean, just off the top of my head, there's a role-playing game based on Storm Constantine's Rethuthu novels, which are kind of sexy science fiction. And she's a great writer, and the books are excellent. I would recommend them to anybody.
Cool name as well.
But yeah, but they are erotic, and therefore the role-playing game deals with a lot of erotic, overt erotic subject matter. I mean, that's fine, because if you're sitting down to play Rethuthu, you know what you're in for. Likewise, there was a great D20 product, which I think went into a second edition, but I read and played the first edition, called Blue Rose. I've forgotten who it was by. I'm sure it was published by Green Ronin. And that was advertised as romantic fantasy. And it was really good at dealing with things like romance and relationships and gender and even kind of transgender and, you know, gender issues. All wrapped up in that kind of that basic fantasy milieu, and it was really excellently done. But it wasn't graphic. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't talking about, you know, hobbit orgies or, you know, sizes of trolls' dicks and all that kind of stuff.
Damn.
I know. We'll move on. There's other books to talk about that deal with that kind of thing. But Blue Rose is that kind of thing where those books will teach GMs and players to include romance and relationships in their games, and that's more like what you were talking about, that chivalric romantic ideal of knights and paladins and courtly love and all those kind of things, which I think are, you know, they're deep rooted in these stories. Lamotte to Arthur, you know, we've got Lancelot and King Arthur and Guinevere, you know, the love triangle there. These things are, we're missing out if we don't use them. But the minute that I think we go over that and we go into, you know, kind of sex mechanics and that kind of thing, I think we're treading on dodgy ground at that point.
Yeah, and I think you're missing the point with that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree, yeah.
It's interesting that it explores, what was that called, Blue Rose?
Blue Rose, yeah.
Interesting that explores sexuality from a variety of angles, because I think one of the draws for role-playing is to do something, play a character that isn't like yourself. So maybe in a respectful table, it could be a good vehicle for exploring a side of sexuality that you're not familiar with outside the game.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, it can be really difficult, because even if you take sex off the table and go back to just dealing with relationships and love and affection and unrequited love even, it can be quite difficult for other players to know how to handle a player's perception or role-playing of that kind of thing. Case in point, actually, a personal experience of mine. I played in a Changeling game a long, long time ago with a group that I was very familiar with, actually. I played a lot of different games with them. And I was playing a troll character, and there was another player who had a she, so like a noble fairy. And part of the idea that's wrapped up in Changeling is a kind of reincarnation idea that the fairy soul is reincarnated into various human bodies over time. Now, the GM had thrown in a little plot hook or curveball, if you will. He was a very good GM, you know, a guy called Andy, and he was great. And he had told me that this noble was basically a reincarnation of my lost love. You know, in a kind of Bram Stoker's Dracula kind of way. You know,
okay.
You know, it was my love reborn, so to speak. So my troll then, in game, pursued romantically, you know, this other player's character. And, you know, I would make romantic gestures and bring them flowers and try and speak to them and, you know, wear a locket with their picture in and all this kind of stuff.
Oh, that's quite nice.
Yeah, it was. And this went on for maybe a couple of sessions, and I was kind of ramping it up slowly. And before the next session, the GM took me to one side and he went, look, you know, Jay, I'm really sorry to say this, but Paul finds it all really uncomfortable. So can you knock this romance thing on the head? Because, you know, he doesn't want you coming on to him in the game, you know, whatever. And I was like, shit, like, okay. And the GM was like, I know, I didn't, you know, I know I created this situation and I'm telling you to stop it. I'm sorry. It's just, you know, the other player had come to him and said, I feel really uncomfortable about this. I don't know why Jay's doing it. And the GM had gone, well, because I told him you were his reincarnated love, so I'm kind of sorry, you know, I'll have a word with him. And it was kind of like, and it was great that it wasn't done at the table, because that would have been potentially even more awkward. But it was still awkward enough then to sit down at that and kind of drop that whole kind of subplot line and to look across to the other player, who I thought I knew pretty well, and I can't understand why he was uncomfortable with it, but I guess that's not my place to understand why he was uncomfortable with it.
But
just
the
idea that he was.
Yeah, and he didn't introduce that concept into his own character. The GM put that in.
The GM put that in?
So maybe that's got something to do with it, maybe.
I think so, yeah. And for whatever reason, he didn't appreciate it. And obviously, that's totally fine. And I'd totally dropped it. I didn't want to do it. And the game actually continued, and it took, and it was fine. We kind of dropped that. That was all kind of done over just two or three sessions, and we managed to get over it. But it's a case in point as to how these things can come out of nowhere, even with a player that you thought you knew, and you thought you were kind of familiar enough with that wouldn't be too awkward, especially when it was only like romantic gestures, and it wasn't anything like, you know, knocking on their door at night and all that sort of stuff, which could have had other, you know, kind of stalkerish connotations. But that happened quite early in what I would call my gaming career, if you want to call it that, for want of a hipster term. But and that always made me think. So I think I was more aware of that kind of interaction from quite early on. And it was nice to see some books and some games and some writers deal with that as things went forward. But the idea of the X card is quite a new concept, really, when you think about role-playing as a hobby. It didn't really come around that long ago, and it became really popular, and now is kind of like a gaming vernacular stable, really.
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe it follows. I mean, we're going to theorize about the direction of society at the moment. I'm sure we sound quite clueless to a lot of people, but I think the X card maybe rose to prominence alongside the idea of being able to talk more openly about your mental health and being able to talk more openly about past trauma and stuff, whereas maybe a decade or two ago that wasn't seen as it wasn't accepted as much widely to be open with things that have happened in your past. So as people have become more comfortable in their true selves, trauma and weaknesses and everything else, that has had to manifest itself into a safer way to play games with strangers. And I think maybe the X card is a product of something like that, perhaps.
I couldn't agree more. I think that's absolutely spot on. I think that's natural. I also think, to add to that, you know, it is a kind of, it's a self-protection tool. You know, we live in a post Me Too world. And I think people have to be careful, especially at conventions and tournaments and things like that, where you are going to do everything that you can to give people the opportunity to express the idea that they're not comfortable. You know, and especially in those kind of situations, those organized situations, I applaud that. And I think that's a good safeguarding measure. I also think part of why the X card became so prevalent is role playing really spread its net quite wide post D&D 5th, with things like Critical Role and all of this kind of thing. And I think D&D 5th brought a lot of players into the role-playing hobby that previously wouldn't have been in the hobby. And I think combination of things like the Big Bang Theory, Stranger Things, Game of Thrones, maybe to a lesser degree, have brought people into the hobby. And it's more mainstream now.
Yes, hello, if you're listening, by the way. Welcome.
Yeah, hello, yeah. And I think those traditional gamers maybe had already figured out how to deal with that or just weren't dealing with that at all. And maybe it was a wake-up call that the gaming industry needed. And maybe the games have gone on too long without the idea of an X card. And maybe it's shame on us as an industry and a group of players that we haven't put those in our games until recently. But either way, I do think it's a combination of all of those things. And, you know, and hobbies develop and, you know, we do live, as you said, we live in modern times and things have changed. So those things have to go in there.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the X card is a strange one. Not to linger on the X card for too long, but it's a strange one because part of me says, if I was running a game for strangers, let's say I'm at a convention, let's say coronavirus isn't happening, wouldn't that be nice? I'm at a convention and I've got strangers sitting down and there's X cards on the table. That is a way for me to say to the stranger, I care about you. I don't know who you are. I don't know anything about you, but I care about you. And that's why this is here. So that if you're uncomfortable, you know that my game will allow you to be safe. So I think it's a good way to telegraph to a stranger that they're going to be protected in that way. But on the other hand, I wouldn't run a game that had uncomfortable things in it for strangers. So I would only...
That's a very good point.
You know, I would keep it friendly and comfortable for strangers anyway. You're not going to sit down if you don't know me and the game's going to get fucking weird and freaky and horrible. I would run a friendly game for strangers, whereas if I were in a gaming group like with my mates, with people I know, I'd be like, all right, let's get fucked up. Yeah, should we do some horrible, nasty shit? And everyone's like, yeah, let's get X-rated, mature. And I know everyone's on the same page. It's very different style, you know, so... Yeah, the X card's a weird one.
And this is exactly what I was saying earlier about, you know, I don't use an X card because I will only bring up those kind of themes with players who I'm fairly comfortable want to handle those kind of themes. And I can't remember the exact details of it, but I'm sure a lot of people listening will remember that tale of the guy who got wrong at a convention for was it, he kidnapped the player characters, I think, and they were all kids or something like that.
Ooh.
I think there was some element where the player characters who were playing children, which is, you know, an odd thing that we can talk about separately in itself. But I think it was kind of like a kids on bike style game, whatever the game kind of was. And I think there was an element, I'm paraphrasing all of this, people will know this story better than me. And there was an element where the GM had their player characters kidnapped and potentially tortured. And I think somebody basically set the alarm off at this, and it was a lot of people upset about that. And I think, I can totally imagine, I don't know how bad it was in the actual game, but why would you set up a plot? Why would you take
a
narrative like that to a convention where you don't know the players? I mean, it's either naivety or something darker. But, you know, if I'm going to give the guy, you know, a kind of pass out, then maybe he just didn't realize that somebody was going to get triggered by that, you know. Somebody had been kidnapped and tortured, you know, which is terrible, you know, obviously. But you've got to run on the assumption that most of your player group, you know, haven't been in Fritzl's dungeon. So, you know, probably not going to have happened. Thankfully, you know, we live in a world where, you know, those things do exist, but they are to a lesser degree, not a greater degree. But you can't blame anybody for sitting down at a table and assuming that everybody's okay. You know?
Yeah. I think one of the main skills of any decent games master worth his salt is to be able to read a room and read a table. And I think that's very important, especially with romance and eroticism and sex. You've got to be able to judge the tone and say to yourself as a games master, is this being received well? Is this going to go in the right direction? If I propose an idea, are they the type of players who are going to either latch onto it or leave it aside? Either one is fine. And is the idea suitable for the table and the players? You know, you've got to be able to have that mental judgment with yourself as a games master, as well as an open discussion with the players. You've got to be able to straddle both those skills, I think.
Yeah, and it's what I was saying before. You know, a good GM will scatter the seeds and will be smart enough to see when the players are receptive to those ideas, and should be smart enough to leave it if the players don't seem to be interested in those particular ideas.
So if I'm a games master and I've got an ongoing campaign of Dungeons and Dragons, and I've decided, I've listened to Human Energy Field, and I think, you know what, that is a romance and love is a part of the human experience that I'm not including enough in my game. How would I go about maybe starting to bring those ideas in to the gaming table?
Okay, so I think there's a few little tips and tricks which you could use to insert romantic ideas into any sort of game, really. But I guess let's talk default. We'll talk about, say, like D&D, but these concepts are applicable to any genre, really. The GM can create NPCs which either have an existing relationship or an old relationship with one of the PCs. Quite often, a player character's background isn't developed as much as it should be. So every player character who sets off adventuring should have an idea of where they came from. So their mother and father, any siblings, you know, wives, children, all of those kind of things. Now, you can introduce an NPC who was an old flame of one of the characters, and you can see how that's perceived, and maybe that is enough to rekindle that relationship, or not. And you can, if you bring in an old flame, say the barbarian, and you bring in another barbarian, and you as the GM explain that at one time you were going to be married to this other barbarian, and then you left the tribe, and you know, it was, you'll be able to see from that player's reaction whether he's interested in, oh, cool, well, let's see how this PC-NPC interaction with my ex turns out as an NPC. And that's very safe because the player can just go, I walk away from her, I don't want to talk to her. And that's a very clear sign from the player to the GM that he's not interested in this NPC interaction. And you can do that to a lesser or greater degree with all of your players to see if anybody kind of finds that interesting. So bringing in old flames or potential new relationships through the method of NPCs is a good one. Also, sometimes it can be worthwhile to bring in an NPC couple together, so two NPCs who are in a relationship already, be they married or man and wife, or you know, young lovers or whatever it happens to be. And then that will pepper the story with the idea of romance, but it's safely in the hands of the GM in an NPC-NPC interaction matrix. And then the PCs may be able to take influence from that, and you know, they can either enjoy part of that storyline, and maybe one of them is kidnapped by goblins and the other has to go out and all this kind of thing. And you know, it's just the idea of love and relationships can then be kind of thrown out to the PCs. And again, the reaction of the players to this storyline might be a good indicator whether to the GM whether they're interested in love and romance and things like this, or they're just not interested at all in which case it's an interesting experiment. You can have those NPCs killed off by said goblins and you don't have to worry about it ever again. So I think NPCs is a really great option. I think a second option would be to produce a location where relationships are more likely, whether that be a house of ill repute, or you could have the local tavern could have a room on the third floor where extra favors are given, by the working girls. And again, this provides a safe environment where the PCs are welcome to travel to that room if they want to, but they also know it exists and can avoid it if they want to.
Right.
And it's a good opportunity for the GM to describe and nudge the fact that a location where eroticism and relationships and stuff are the order of the day, and see the PC's reaction to that. And, it doesn't have to be a brothel. It could be, a court of intrigue or a temple of a god who is, god of the family or god of love or whatever. A temple dedicated to Athena or whatever it happens to be, where the priestesses are, like kind of almost holy virgins and things like that. There's loads of different ways that you could do it. And again, it's all about judging the players' reactions to whatever you provide to them.
It's about consent, isn't that? That's the underlying theme here, is that it's always about consent. That's the most important thing.
And don't make it a thing that the PCs have to 100% deal with to move the story onwards. Make it a little subplot or an idea or an NPC or a location that the PCs can happily ignore and walk away from. And that, as a GM, should tell you everything.
So it's never about being railroaded one way or another. Because I guess that's how love works, right? Love is diverse, so your options in a game should be too.
Yeah, and I mean, don't get me wrong, in real life, we can have situations where we have to deal with things head on. But you've got to remember that the gaming experience is there for everybody to have fun. And what you're doing is gauging how much fun your player characters are having by the opportunities you're presenting them in the game world. And if they're not really into it, they'll let you know by swiftly moving on to other things.
Yeah, I think that's probably the safest and, in a lot of ways, the most fun way to do it, because, as with anything else, you're planting the seeds of an idea for players to pick up on, and then if they are invested players, they will take it in a direction that you perhaps had not predicted as the games master, and you might end up in a situation that you had no idea you'd cause, but the players have grokked what you're doing, that I really like this, but here's the angle I want to take with my character, or here's how my character would perceive this idea. And suddenly then you've got another collaborative subplot that you didn't have before, if done correctly.
Yeah. And I think another useful tool that the GM can use is to look at the character sheet that all players have created, and to see if any player has thrown a lot of dots or backgrounds or points or whatever into things like high charisma, high appearance, any sort of persuasion, all of these skills and abilities and attributes that might indicate that the player is interested in getting into those situations and those not necessarily confrontations, but dealing with NPCs with those skills. And that might be a good idea for the GM then to give those players somebody of the opposite sex or same sex, depending upon orientation, for them to interact with. Whether it's a contact or an ally or an NPC fresh off the street, and then you might find that PC really gets into that, and a relationship there could develop between the PC and the NPC, and then that could be used as further plot points, etc. That would be quite useful.
Do you think it gets more complicated when the players are already in a relationship, maybe GM and player or two players are together? And they're trying to roleplay at the same table? That's going to complicate things a little bit, no?
I think what we're entering here is the second part, the second wider part of this discussion, because everything we've mentioned so far is dealing with the relationships of imaginary characters in an imaginary world. Now we're starting to deal with the relationships between the players at the table and the potential pitfalls that can come with having people in those relationships at the table. So yeah, let's get into that. I'm excited to get into that.
Right. I mean, I there are pros and cons. I would say a good couple shouldn't really let it affect them and should be able to role play their characters separate to themselves. most of the couples that have sat at my table, if I'm a games master, I've had a lot of player groups where I've had couples in my player groups, and a lot of the time they choose that their characters are in a relationship with each other that's almost exactly like the one that they have, and they both seem quite happy with it. It's not up to me to really challenge that, but at the same time, I would recommend them. I do recommend to them at least try and have it some kind of difference. If you're going to have a relationship between yourselves, at least make it different to what you guys are and broaden your life experience just a little bit further out.
I think most couples, and I'm going to make a sweeping generalization, most couples who come to a gaming table will play a couple in the game. Every time I've seen it happen.
Yeah.
It's the exception to the rule when it doesn't happen.
Yeah.
And also what you'll tend to find, and you might agree with this or not, is normally when there's a couple at the table, one of them is a gamer, the other is just tagging along. So you don't tend to find that both players in the relationship at the table are gamers in their own right. Now, the partner, for want of a better word, to the gamer might now be a gamer because they've been doing it for long enough. But they were brought into the hobby so that their partner, who went off on a Saturday afternoon or a Thursday night or whatever, oh, well, why are you leaving me to go and do this? Can I not come with you? Well, I suppose, if you want to play the game. And that's the only way that they feel they can get to spend that time with their partner. They tag along and their partner essentially creates a character for them, which is, oh, well, I'm going to be your girlfriend in the game because I'm your girlfriend in real life. Why aren't you going to cast your healing spells on me and I want half your treasure and all of these kind of things. And you'd be surprised how common that is with couples.
Yeah.
One tends to be the gamer and one tends to be, for want of a better purpose, a hanger-on who isn't really interested in the game. They're only there because their partner is.
I can't say I've never ran groups with that where that's happened, because that definitely has been the case in the past. And then that brings with it a whole lot of subtext outside of the game, which can sometimes manifest itself at the gaming table in character.
I'd rather lose a player than have an extra player who doesn't give a shit.
Yeah.
So if I had a regular player in my group who insisted on bringing his partner along, even though I could tell his partner or her partner was not interested in this at all, I'd be like, look, if you guys need more time together, then I suggest you take it, and I would make a polite excuse, I don't need that many players, or whatever it happens to be. And if I had to be blunt, I'd be like, look, I don't need this in my game, unfortunately. You have to be strong enough as a couple to come on your own, or your partner has to be interested in the game. And if they are, of course, I'll welcome them in with open arms and help them create characters. But you can immediately tell a partner who's coming along who is invested in the game and interested and wants to learn and wants to play. And what you'll tend to find is those players will not play the girlfriend or wife or whatever of the other player. They will strike out on their own. Oh, well, you're a wizard of, you're an elf wizard. I'm going to be a dwarf fighter. This is what I want, I want it to be like a character awesome. In this novel I've read or this TV show I've seen. And you can see that excitement
love
straight away.
That. Yeah,
and then everybody just gets behind that, and then that's great. And, there are always going to be these little idiosyncrasies between couples who are in a relationship at the table. They'll always help each other out in game and stuff, and that's fine. But it's not that kind of hanger-on who goes, come on, honey, it's your time to roll dice in combat, and they're on their phone and... Do you know what I mean?
Right,
like they're like, oh, yeah, whatever,
oh,
okay.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah. Mate,
what spell should I use? Yeah, and I mean, I've done that more times than I can mention, especially when I've been running, actual gaming clubs where you have a lot less control over who comes in, quite rightly so, it's for everybody. But I think at your own personal table, I think it's only right that you don't have to deal with a lot of these options,
yeah.
A lot of these things. And it can be very disruptive for a game, I think, to have somebody there who isn't invested anyway, whether it's somebody's partner or not. Nobody needs somebody around the table who doesn't really give a shit. But unfortunately, I think in 99% of the cases, when there's a couple at the table, one of them shouldn't really be there.
I don't know about 99%. I disagree with that.
Yeah, I can only go off the microcosm of experience that I've had in this, my fleeting mortal life so far. But in my experience and talking to other people, it tends to be pretty much most of the time.
Right. I have had times where someone I have been in a relationship with has played in a game that I am running, and I have found that whatever expectations they may have of favoritism or whatever else, I try and do my best to stay neutral, obviously. But
yeah.
A good advantage I have found of that is, let's say I'm in a relationship with someone, everyone comes around, we have a game, everyone else leaves, or we leave, or whatever it is. I then get an intimate debrief that I may not have got from a player, where the partner in question is saying, you know, I actually thought you could improve here, or what you did here wasn't great. And you kind of unlock that extra level of critique and friendship that you might not get with a mate, where you can actually kind of learn and understand a bit more about your style of presenting a game and presenting a world from someone who understands you and your motivations more than a player or a stranger or a friend. So there's something to be said for having that around, I think, in one way.
Yeah, of course, that's great. And that all that does is show that there's a great setup of communication there between two people who are comfortable enough to share ideas and to want to make each other better. And, you know, that's a great thing. And, you know, if there is a long-standing relationship in a game where there's, you know, somebody's running the game and one of the players happens to be their wife or their partner or whatever, of course that does exist. You know, my generalizations are talking about what I would call the kind of standard Saturday night game where a right. group of friends come together, whether it's, you know, uni or work or all that kind of thing. I mean, once you get to like home groups and like groups that have known each other for years and years and decades, the relationship issues between those partners starts to fizzle away and to be less of an issue, I think, once you get like, you know, long established gamers who've been doing it a long time, because what it means is that the partners are there because they want to be. And really, that's the big barrier between what the problems that I'm pointing out and what can be really rewarding. And I think once you get to that point where, you know, and I'm sure people can definitely bring people they're married to, and the people they're married to aren't really interested. Well, I think they're interested, but they don't want to play the game. And that can be, I've seen that quite a lot, and it can be quite difficult because they're like, they want to be let into this part of their partner's world that their partner finds so intriguing and interesting. And, you know, they might be lying next to them in bed reading an RPG rule book or whatever. And, you know, tell me about this is that you're reading, and the partner is very enthusiastic about it. And, you know, and the game is great. And of course that partner then wants to join in and be part of that thing that makes their partner really happy. But I don't think that's necessarily the best reason to make sure that your partner plays in every game that you play in. You know, it's okay to have separate hobbies sometimes and stuff like that. And then I'm starting to sound like a relationship counselor at that point, you know, and I'm not. Everybody has to take their own path and make their own judgments about whether they want to take their partners into the role-playing game or whether they're happy to leave them outside. But what I would say is, if you know your partner isn't interested in the game and you know they're only doing it to spend time with you, then please try and deal with that before you get to the gaming table. For the good of the game, for the other players, please just have a word with your, you know, partner and just say, look, I get why you want to spend some more time with me. Is it this? Is it that? But I don't think this is for you. You're not going to like it. I mean, you obviously can't do that before they've tried. People have to try things. Do you know what I mean? But at some point, you've got to draw the line and go, look, you know, no. So.
Yeah, I think so. But I think communication and wanting each other to grow is the sign of a healthy relationship. And if you don't have that, then try and strive towards that, I would say, because
absolutely. Yeah. And any partner who doesn't want to introduce their partner to the hobby that they love, that's a problem in itself, you know?
I suppose, yeah,
of course. You can tell. We all know whether people are interested in something or not. But people who seem to have an active interest, of course you should you know, develop that and encourage it and allow it to grow. But what I'm basically saying is, don't force it on anybody and don't let anybody get into it when you know they're not interested, because that can be really difficult.
Yeah. And as a GM, it's an absolute nightmare having passive aggressive behavior at the gaming table between two players while I've got another three players here all waiting for an argument to finish or whatever else it might be, or there's like glances being thrown across the table. It's such a nightmare. So If you know anyone or you're in that situation, please do your best to resolve it for the good of your friends and to keep the game alive. Don't let your own issues destroy something beautiful, please. It's happened. I've seen it happen too many times.
And don't ever think that if you form a relationship in game with someone who isn't your real life partner, that your real life partner isn't going to get upset by that, because they are, and they have every right to do so. So just don't do it. It's not worth it. I've seen it happen in LARPs and stuff, man. That is, wow. It's grim.
Wow.
Yeah, well, like there's a couple played in a game, and the guy, his character was in love with another character, so would follow that character around in the game and protect her and everything. Whereas his real life wife was his enemy in the game, and I just thought this Freud's having a wonderful time.
There's some stuff going on there, right?
Yeah. Oh, there was some stuff going on there, and you could tell. And this was like, this is not okay.
That was a LARP, you know, instead.
This was a LARP as well. Me. So you know, this was tragic. A LARP. Yeah. Yeah, very. Needless to say, that relationship didn't end well. But yeah, and you can tell things like that. So you know, don't allow the game to cover up these little things as well. So I think we're getting slightly off topic with, but I guess it is relationships, isn't it? And it, you know,
bring us back onto topic then.
Okay, so to bring us back into topic, I would say that what we want to do is encourage romance, love in role-playing games. And the one thing maybe we haven't touched on is eroticism in role-playing games, because we talked about romantic relationships, etc., but we're almost straying into this back to where we came at the beginning, where we're talking about the apocalypse world sex mechanic. How far should you push the romance into eroticism before it becomes vulgar? And I guess that's different for every group and every player. But I think there is quite a fine line there.
Yeah, I think it's contextual with the game as well. If I was playing some kind of femme fatale honeypot and it was key to the narrative that I seduced someone to gain information or whatever it might be, I would be much more interested in playing out a specific sex scene because I'm waiting with my dice in hand, ready for the perfect moment to pounce to do something that I'm in my head I need to do for the good of the narrative. So something like that, a sex scene can be relevant and drive the story that everyone's collaborating on together. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, and I think we can take our cue from movies maybe at this point, where we can all watch movies and we can all feel like a scene, an erotic scene that's happened was justified within the narrative. And we all know when one really isn't justified in the narrative.
Yeah, that's it.
And I think if we take the same approach to the scenes in our role-playing games, then that's a good benchmark to go by, you know, in terms of what we're dealing with and why we're dealing with it. And I think any discussion of sex and romance, et cetera, in role-playing games would be amiss if we didn't mention the Book of Erotic Fantasy.
Oh, tell me more.
The Book of Erotic Fantasy was part of the great D20 OGL wave that happened in the early 2000s when Wizards of the Coast decided to let the mechanics for D&D 3rd/3.5 out into the wide open gamersphere and allow people to publish source books based on those mechanics. This wave saw many weird and wonderful products come out, many of them absolute dross, but some of them quite good. Now, one of the unusual nuggets of gaming wisdom that came out in that wave was the Book of Erotic Fantasy. I believe it came out in about 2004. Off the top of my head, I can't remember who published it, but I think it was a small publisher. It wasn't one of the big ones. And it was a D&D sourcebook, hardback, full colour, that dealt specifically with sex, for want of a better word, in Dungeons & Dragons. So it was all about sexual orientation of demi-humans, sexual practices, sexual skills, sexual prestige classes, sexual magical items, all of those kind of things. And it's a real unusual one, because if I saw it on somebody's D&D shelf that I was sitting down to play a game, I'd be like, that's a bit weird.
I'm about to pre-order.
Good luck finding it. I think it's quite desirable on the secondary market now.
Okay, right.
I mean, I've got a copy, but obviously just as a curio, you know,
if anyone else had it, it'd be really weird.
I would judge them immediately. But the stuff in it is quite full on, you know, and it's kind of, as far as kind of Photoshop nudity in the book itself, and you know, it doesn't pull any punches. And for that, it's a brave product, and it's an unusual product, and it's interesting to gaming collectors and readers, because there's nothing really quite like it. And I don't think that kind of product for D&D and fantasy gaming in general was really seen until we start getting the more full-on Lamentations products.
Right.
That started going back into that idea, you know, of dealing with sex and eroticism and stuff.
That's more exploitative, isn't it? That kind of thing, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. But I think this book of erotic fantasy was almost like a, you know, a proto version of that idea, that kind of B-movie, grindhouse kind of... It didn't take itself massively seriously. You know, there was tongue-in-cheek humour running throughout the book, which I think makes it work slightly better, because it didn't feel quite as seedy, because you could tell the people writing it and putting it together were having a bit of a laugh with it, and that kind of makes you relax when you're kind of reading through this really weird stuff. And it's more of a toolbox, like all of these third 3.5 books are, which, you know, you can liberally sprinkle your game with these kind of sexual things if you want to, or just take little ideas from it. But yeah, it's a really unusual book, so for people of who like weird and wonderful D&D books, it's one to search out for sure.
I've got some pretty strange things on my shelf, but nothing in that vein, so maybe that's something that I'll have to try and obtain at some point. I'm not trying to think too hard about sexual magical items, and I'm trying to think about what some prestige classes might be.
I mean, there's three prestige classes in there off the top of my head. It's been a long time since I looked through that book. It's not something that I would delve into and look for any inspiration in my games, really. It is one of those books that's really just there as an oddity.
Right.
In my personal opinion, there's not a lot in there that would add value to a game. So, but it's just unusual in the sense that there's nothing really quite like it.
Yeah, okay, I'll get that. I mean, I wouldn't... if you have a narrative that relies on eroticism, then maybe it's quite weak. You know, you don't want a story that's going to rely on something being sexy in order to, like, as its crux. You want the sexiness to come alongside whatever else is happening within the context of the situation, and that's probably why it's sexy, because it's got context to it.
Yeah.
Instead of just going, this is a sexy thing, and then dropping it in front of your players and expecting them all to find it sexy, that's not really how it works, is it?
No. But I think to draw to a conclusion, I think part of what this discussion is meant to do is to encourage people to bring love, for want of a better word, into the games. However that love may define itself, whether it's the love for a family member, the love for a sibling, the love for a wife, or a whatever it happens to be, because many of these old stories have these ideas of unrequited love and, you know, fate, people should be together, and, you know, princes and princesses and all of this idea. To avoid that, I think, is to miss a very ripe fruit that can be taken and enjoyed by the group. So I would encourage people to kind of think about love and romance, and to a degree eroticism, but I don't think that's as important as the romantic and aspects of a game that can be added.
I think so. I think it shows that a character is flesh and blood, you know, they've got that side to them, and it's something that, if ignored, I think you are missing a trick a little bit with that kind of thing.
Yeah, and I think romance carries with it the kind of unspoken promise of eroticism anyway. Even if you don't want to bring that into your games, it kind of peeks in through the window just by introducing romance into them, and that can often be enough to make your games feel more vibrant anyway, without feeling the need to shock your players or to, you know, entice them into some sort of erotic situation.
Agreed. Consent is important. Love is diverse, and our expressions should reflect that, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Very, you know, wise words, well said.
Thanks, man.
Yeah. Did you have that written down beforehand?
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was just checking my notes here, man. I thought that was something. Thank you for listening. I hope this has helped in some way, or maybe you've just killed an hour of time. Thanks for listening to us. Any excuse to talk about role-playing games, isn't that right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and you might agree with everything we've said, you might agree with none of what we've said, but if it makes you think a little bit more about the games you're running, the games you've ran, or the games you're going to run, then it's worth doing.
I absolutely am going to try and include this aspect of humanity into more of my games. I think it's something that it's something that's important to me, and it's something that I'd like to stress the importance of to my players as well.
Yeah, don't be afraid to include these things in your game, I think, is our closing message.
Agreed. Well, thank you for this, Jamie. Thank you to everyone who's listened. Hope you've enjoyed this bonus episode. We'll be back again with another one towards the end of February. So stay tuned for that. As always, stay hydrated, and I'll see you next time.
Good night.